4 years ago, when Mel Brooks was honored as an official national treasure at the Kennedy Center, President Obama described him this way.
As you can tell, he was born to entertain. Or as Mel Brooks explains it, look at Jewish history. Unrelieved lamenting would be intolerable. So every 10 Jews, God designed one to be crazy and amuse the others.
And now 2013 brings still more honors for Mel Brooks. In June, he'll receive the American Film Institute's Lifetime Achievement Award. In May, PBS premieres its American Masters documentary, Mel Brooks, Make a Noise. As if I needed an excuse to want to sit down for this interview, Mel Brooks, welcome to Studio 360.
Kurt Anderson.
We often ask people on this show, was there a moment when you decided, my life has changed because I've seen this thing or read this book or whatever? I understand yours was really like that when you saw Anything Goes on Broadway.
Well, I was about 9 years old, and my Uncle Joe comes over and says, Uncle Joe drove a cab. If you saw a cab coming down the street without a driver, that was Joe. He was incredibly short. So Joe used to take these doormen to various theaters on Broadway, the ones that lived in Brooklyn, back to Brooklyn at night when he was rounding up his night. And he would just pick up these guys from, one of them was at the Alvin Theater, and told him he would get him some tickets to this new show that was opening called Anything Goes. So Joe took me to see, I think it was like the third or fourth night of the run of Anything Goes.
1934 then.
Yeah. No microphones. We were sitting in the last two seats in the last row of the balcony, and I thought that Ethel Merman was still a little too loud.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors.
Had you ever seen a show before?
I'd never seen a show, and I think I went a little crazy. I think I went nuts. I kept singing all the songs all through the night. I love the ballads as well as, you know, You're the Top. And the spirit, the joy that emanated from that stage that filled the audience with craziness and love and happiness and comedy and bounce. And I said, this is it, you know. I knew then that I would not be one of the citizens who lived at 365 South 3rd Street to enter the Garment Center. I didn't want to be a shipping clerk. It's one life, and I'm going to live it on that stage with footlights and with a big orchestra in the pit and singing my heart out, you know.
And then you get back from the war and start writing for television at this extraordinary crucible, and you spend a decade doing that. And was it as a writer for Sid Caesar with Carl Reiner that you started developing The 2,000-Year-Old Man?
That wasn't my doing. That was Carl Reiner. He had this wire recorder, which was brand new in 1951 or two. And he'd walk over to me and he'd say, I understand that, sir, that you're actually 2,000 years old. And
you lived, of course, during the time of Christ.
I knew him, a nice boy.
You knew Jesus?
Oh, he's a nice, lovely, thin, a nice little boy.
Yes. I mean, is he as
he wore sandals.
He wore sandals.
Wore sandals.
Very much as he's pictured today in the motion pictures that we see of him.
Well, they made a travesty of it.
Well, didn't Jesus behave that
way? No, he was quiet, a quiet lad.
He didn't do that.
No, he came in the store. He never bought anything.
You had a store.
That's a 2,000-year-old man. In the new PBS documentary about you, Rob Reiner says that his father, Carl Reiner, he had this way of painting you into a corner in that bit, and that you are at your best when you're painted into the corner. You agree with that?
I say something, and then Carl challenges me on it, and I know I'm trapped. And, you know, he knew I would come up with something, and he always pushed me into a corner, you know.
Really? And so you really, over the years, improvised that bit into all of its many versions?
Well, the first two albums were almost completely ad-lib. I never knew what the question was going to be, and I never knew what answer I would come up with. But after that, when we became kind of known for it, and we were put on things like the Ed Sullivan Show or the Hollywood Palace, We were only given 4 or 5 minutes to do our act and get our laughs. So we wrote down what we wanted to do.
Earlier in the show, we heard from Billy Crystal, who called that routine the comedian's Bible. Why do you think that is? What was it that indoctrinated so many funny people that this was part of their catechism?
I think because it captured an immigrant sensibility. It was the quickness of the Jewish immigrant who got off the boat and kind of made a living on the Lower East Side, opened a store, put herrings in a barrel and sold them. Maybe the second week he was in America, the 2,000-year-old man kind of captures some of the joie de vivre, the spirit of making a life for the immigrant.
Yeah. I became familiar with you through seeing and listening to that album and then seeing you on The Tonight Show, watching it with my father as a little kid. And I had never seen my small-town Nebraska lawyer father laugh at anything as hard as he laughed at you every time you were on television. And
isn't that nice? He was a lawyer, a small-town lawyer in Omaha?
Yep.
That's beautiful because that's Johnny Carson, who was interviewing me,
yes,
was from Omaha.
Yes. Well, Johnny Carson, whom my mother hired to perform magic at the University of Nebraska Student Union. So there you go.
Oh, my God. That's incredible. Wow.
Before we talk some more, let's hear a little of Springtime for Hitler from 1968.
Germany was having trouble. What a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
Now, as I listen to that, I mean, of course, it's now that I've been around for a while. It's amazing that that's only 23 years after the war. I wonder if one of the reasons it did work is because of the 1968 craziness. The world was being turned upside down and conventionalism was being thrown out the window.
I was very lucky. Things got restricted and constricted later. I couldn't do Blazing Saddles today.
That's interesting.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't use the N-word so freely and furiously as I use it in Blazing Saddles.
That's certainly true.
I don't think I could even punch a horse, let alone a little old lady. It was, somewhere between 65 and 75 was a time of great comic freedom in America. And I think this new American Masters that you'll see on PBS May 20th at 9 p.m., does capture a lot of that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other movie ever made that was as, well, the nice word would be bold.
Yeah.
The real word would be an execrable taste, you know.
Well, let's play a scene from that film where the new black sheriff, played by Cleavon Little, is being insulted, dangerous, Kurt. Insulted by a townsperson and then comforted by his pal, played by Gene Wilder.
Good morning, ma'am. And isn't it a lovely morning? Up yours.
Oh, Jesus.
What did you expect? Welcome, Sonny. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know. Morons.
That was a good moment.
It was a great moment. And Gene Wilder had become your pal and kind of muse and collaborator in The Producers. What was it about him and you together that worked so well, do you think?
I don't know. We were on the kind of, you know, the same frequency, the same wavelength. And we knew that, you know, comedy didn't work without humanity. We didn't care about the comedy that said, so my wife said, you never take me anywhere. Take me to a new place. I want to see new places. So I took her to the kitchen, you know, yeah. Which is funny, you know, as Hannah Youngman. But that was not the comedy that thrilled or excited us. The comedy that excited us were what was actually happening to people. And if we could point it out in a humorous way, we knew that they'd get it. We were not the comedy of privilege, and we were not the comedy of stand-up and one-liners. Uh-huh. We were the, what I learned from Sid Caesar, we were the comedy, I think, without being too, you know, puffy, or with humanity. I mean, we just cared about people.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky. Richard Pryor was supposed to play that the black guy. And Warner Brothers said, no, he's a druggie. We know he takes drugs, and we know this, and we know too much about him. And and this was before Richard Pryor became a big, big star. They were so stupid. Anyway, I conducted auditions, and I couldn't find anybody close to Richard Pryor, who was really maybe the best, outside of Sid Caesar, the best comedian that ever lived.
Yep, absolutely agree with you.
And Richie was with me, and you know, Richie said the most weird thing. When we saw a Cleavon Little, Richie said, this guy's laid back, he knows what he's doing. And he says, let me tell you, you may have gotten lucky, you may have taken a good bounce here, Mel. I said, what do you mean? He said, he's black. I'm kind of coffee-colored. You say the black sheriff, you want to scare the shit out of those people, you really bring in a real black man. And he was not only black, he was beautiful. He was the handsomest guy I ever saw in my life.
I was amazed, as I was doing research for this, that Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles both came out in 1974, which is kind of – I thought it must have been a mistake.
You know, it's just an accident, because it was like the year in Variety. Here I was. It was amazing. I was looking at it. 365 South 3rd Street between Hooper and Keep, you know, on the top floor and in the back, not even in the front of the building, $16 a month. The baby of a family who lost a father when I was 2 years old. My mother had to do the diapers, had to cook and clean and scrub linoleum floors. And there I was, 1-2.
Yep.
1-2 in Variety.
The hottest hand in Hollywood.
Yes. I mean, it was just amazing.
So you had these amazing string of successes in the 70s and into the 80s. Did you feel when you had less commercial films in the 90s, less successful ones, did you think like, what's going on? Have I lost it?
Exactly. And I said, have I lost it? And the answer came to me kind of in a dream. Yes, you have. You have lost it. Go away. Go back to being a shipping clerk for the Abilene Blouse and Dress Company.
So you've had, kind of amazingly, these several separate big careers, TV writer, comedy personality, movie director, movie producer, Broadway, auteur. If you had to, like, attribute it to what percentage talent, what percentage tenacity, ambition, and what percentage luck?
That's good. You're right. You know, it's, you know, the easiest thing to tell you, and probably the most correct, break it into thirds and you got it. Just what you said.
Yeah.
What did you say?
Talent, tenacity and ambition, and luck.
Okay. The first would be tenacity and ambition. Coming really out of the gutters, literally out of the gutters, out of the streets of Brooklyn. You know, fighting to make my way in a world that I was not really, that we were disenfranchised. We were not part of it. We were kind of, you know, the tenement dwellers, the poor of the world, you know, and we didn't make decisions about the world. We just try to keep our heads above water. So tenacity and ambition, absolutely. The baby of three other brothers, you know, fighting for my, you know.
Which, by the way, as a youngest child of four myself, I see in you the super version of the youngest child. This, you know, you have all the character, it seems to me, of a youngest kid.
Yes, I do. But I also had – my father died when I was only two, and my mother – I didn't learn to walk till I was five. I was always in her arms. She always loved me. She always she always felt this warmth and this – the sadness that here's this baby not growing up with a daddy. And, you know, and so she gave me – tried to give me daddy and her mommy love, you know. And and she really loved me. And, you know, and I think if you got your mother's love and you got your mother's attention and love – you can't go wrong.
Right.
And I had an older brother, my brother Irving, who acted as a surrogate father. I'm there. I'm saying, how many people signed a declaration? I can't do this homework. I cannot do this homework. I got three. I think I've got Jefferson, Franklin, and Washington signed. He said, no, you're wrong. Washington never signed that. So I said, who the hell? They want 20 names at signing the Declaration of Independence. Oh, my God. You know, and Irving said, well, where do you play, you know, punch ball? I said, on Marcy Avenue. He said, where's the signer? He said, where do we live? I said, on Hooper. Where's the signer? Where's this?
That's great.
Where's the street that you go, where your school, PS90? I said, use. There's a signer. Where's the library? Rodney, there's a signer. You know, and it went on and on. I said,
That's
oh, my
fantastic.
God, I got it. I got it. That's why they call it Williamsburg. All the streets are signers of the tech. And I was living in it. You know, that was my homework. And Irving, he saved my life, you know.
Mel Brooks. I want to thank you so much. This was such a pleasure for me.
It was good for me, too.
The PBS American Masters documentary, Mel Brooks, Make a Noise, premieres nationwide on May 20th.
May 20th. Good, good. I'm glad you said it.
Yes.
Because it's not nice if I just keep pushing it.
There you go.
But they had a great subject. They had me in my life. I mean, they were working with gold. What can I tell you?
Mel Brooks, thanks a lot.
Kurt Anderson, I can't thank you enough, so no thanks.
Good.
No. It was easy. That's the best thing I could say about anything. I could say this was easy.
I agree.
It was great.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay.
Kurt, keep in touch. Don't be strange.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
See ya.
All right, see ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I met Mel Brooks for the first time 35 years ago on my first job out of college working for Gene Shalit at the Today Show. When I brought up that encounter, Mel Brooks told me how Shalit is the reason that he has a career in film, in his opinion. You can hear that story at studio360.org.